This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Welcome back to Dreamland. I'm your monthly guest host, Kelly Chase. Whitley will be back in the captain's chair next week. This week, I had the pleasure of sitting down with one of the best researchers in the field, my friend Daniel Elizondo. Daniel is the co-author of Loose Threads, which is available as a free PDF download that I'll link to in the description. Loose Threads is, frankly, one of the most remarkable and revelatory pieces of work that's been done in terms of understanding the history of ufology and how it relates to the current disclosure movement. Loose Threads traces the history of the Advanced Theoretical Physics Working Group, which was a collaboration of contractors, scientists, and intelligence community officials devoted to uncovering the truth about the government's involvement with UFOs, exotic technologies, and related phenomena. The group, formed and directed by Colonel John B. Alexander in the mid-80s, is an incredible lens through which we can begin to understand the major players that have created the current ufological world as we know it, and whose influence continues to be felt. Daniel will also be featured in the upcoming docuseries for my media company, Ontocalypse Productions, along with Whitley Strieber, Jeffrey Kripal, Diana Walsh-Pasulka, Michael Masters, J. Christopher King, and many others. The docuseries will be released under the name Cosmosis, UFOs and a New Reality, and will be available on Apple TV and Amazon Prime right around the new year. I think that Daniel is one of the most important new writers, researchers, and thinkers in the field, and I'm so excited to share this conversation with all of you. Without further ado, here is my conversation with Daniel Elizondo. All right. Well, hi, Daniel. Welcome to Dreamland. It's so great to have you here.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
Yeah, it's been a while since we've seen each other. This year's gone so fast. I think the last time we saw each other, we were in Houston shooting for the docuseries.
Yeah. Wow. That feels like, was it like 6 months ago? Is that over the summer? Yeah.
Yeah. It was March, actually. If we can.
Okay. Wow. In the spring. Wow. Yeah. That's, it feels like it's been a really long time.
And sure. So lots happened. I'm super excited to catch up with you. I'm so glad you're here. So for people who maybe aren't familiar with you or aren't familiar with your background, the question I always love to ask, because the answer is always very interesting, how did you end up in this weird UFO world? What is your origin story?
I think my origin story is that I'm a contrarian. I think that we have a lot of contrarians in the UFO community and, you know, just in the experiencer community probably as well. And so I think that's, you know, I probably got into this subject probably in high school. Maybe I was in college, but yeah, very, very kind of a normie entry. I remember watching Stephen Greer's events, you know, and things like that on YouTube. I remember watching, you know, just kind of being more interested in, you know, some of the things you might see on Fox, like the alien autopsy. You know, docuseries and a lot of those things that kind of make you cringe now and you're looking at it. But at the same time, back then, you know, you're young, you don't know a lot of what's going on. And I think it was always kind of a low key, you know, I had a few books, I kept up with it. If it came up, you know, at the bar with friends or something like that, they would always look at me and tell, oh, you know, you become kind of the UFO person with your friends, right? I think that really was sort of the level of my engagement with it. I think for a lot of people, you know, 2017 was a big entry point for them in sort of learning about the topic. And for me, I feel like it was just sort of a reinvigoration and getting me a little bit more active and interested in the subject, interacting with people online. I'll say it also, you know, kind of correlated around, and this is probably, you know, resonate for a lot of people, a lot of experiencers, just around a lot of trauma and loss and things like that happening all at once. So, you know, lost a loved one. My house got pretty much direct hit by a small tornado and had my first child, had things going, like big work transitions going on. And it was at the same time, this is around in 2019. So it's COVID stuff is going on. So it's like a lot of things all at once kind of coalesced. And that's when, you know, sort of like the, you know, really getting active in writing about on the topic, just on a blog, right? Putting some thoughts out there. It all kind of happened around then. And I started writing before that, but it's almost like there was a center of gravity, if you will, in time where you start really starting to engage, and then all of this stuff happens, and your engagement or the way that you engage really shifts. And so I'd say that happened to me as well. I've never had any sort of a classical UFO experience or interaction with what I would call, what some people call a non-human intelligence. I don't know how much I subscribe to that sort of that framing anyway. But I've had a few things, especially in that realm. A book encounter that I had that was pretty interesting, and a few other things. But yeah, I don't have any really amazing experience or story, but I do have a lot of those, just some of those patterns that you see in terms of where people are in their lives when the phenomenon kind of enters their life that they notice the phenomenon interacting with them seemingly in a way that is, it's a little bit more different than maybe it had before, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. I was actually just having a conversation in the last episode I did with Robin Lassiter, who's a member of the Experiencer Group and an author and a podcaster. Really cool. We were having that conversation it's funny how many of us end up engaging more deeply in this field, and it's around some sort of a work that we feel compelled and almost like obsessed with, like this, there's this thing that we have to do. And like, I definitely can see in sort of just like the level and the detail and the rigor of your work that like, this isn't something that someone with like a normal level of interest in the topic.
Yeah. I definitely, there's a quote that, it's not by the most reputable character, but I think I think it was Ed Dames actually who said it. He was talking about experiencers that they were looking at, and he said that they'd all been shanghaied into doing some kind of work. I think that that's really a really funny thing. And I'm like, yeah, I've been shanghaied, right? Like, I know I've been shanghaied, and I'm going along with that. But I think it can sometimes feel like that. Definitely feel like I've got some work to do, and definitely feels more like an obsession than just an interest at times. But I love to do it, obviously.
Yeah, no, I can see that in your work. I really enjoyed when we first got to meet each other earlier this year down in Houston. We were at the Archives of the Impossible together, and you got there a few days earlier, and like you had pulled like, what was it, like 30 some boxes of like Ed Mays archives? Is that right? It was a kind of crazy number, and you really got through a lot of it too. I was really impressed.
Yeah, they were not thrilled with me. I was definitely too ambitious with that. I got in over my head there, and I knew I only had a set amount of time, and there was so much stuff that I wanted to look at that I was just like, in my defense, I did ask them. I said, how many is it like normal? Is it okay if I ask? And they said, no, you can ask for as many as you want. And I really, gave them a run for their money there. So I think they were pretty suspicious. And then they realized that, oh, this guy, he's just kind of an idiot. He doesn't know, right? Sure, not that it's unreasonable. He's not going to get through all of this. But yeah, I definitely was out there just sort of panic scanning just so that I could, vacuum as much in, for my own collections, because I like to be able to, use a search engine in Google Drive. That was really a fun experience. And yeah, there's so much that I did not get to. Like I got to maybe, look at my list even now. I mean, I maybe got through 10% of the things that I wanted to get to. So I hope to be able to get out there more and keep digging in. Great resource if nobody's ever been there. I highly recommend it.
That's very cool. And I think, something I appreciate so much about your work is that you're doing like the real research. Like sometimes people call me a researcher and I don't think I actually qualify as a researcher. I think I'm more of an aggregator at best, a synthesizer perhaps. But like the actual work of like diving into the archives and doing all of that takes a tremendous amount of work and attention to detail. And, you've managed in your work to kind of uncover a history that I think that we might have otherwise lost in terms of just the history of ufology. Could you talk a little bit about like what your the focus of your work has been and, you know, what excites you so much about that?
Yeah. I think, you know, one thing is, I feel like I approach my work the way that I have to approach my work, right? I can talk. There's no doubt about that. I'm not a great interviewer. And I think that there is something, you know, there's so many good interviewers out there, especially now, with excellent podcasts like yours and, you know, and also a lot of like investigative journalists and, you know, just regular people who just got after it and they're doing that work. And I'm just not, I'm really not a great investigator in that way. And so I kind of try and stick to what I can do, which is like falling down a rabbit hole and being obsessed. Like I'm good at that. That's like my talent is being obsessed. And so I think one of the things that's been really great for me is being able to look at other people who were obsessed, right, in the past. And I think a lot of times, especially these days, it's really interesting to see the UFO community sort of like coalesce against the UFO community as a concept and as a history. And I think that it's really important, and I'm glad you teed this up for me. I think it's really important to really recognize that a lot of the things that we know today, we do not know because the intelligence community handed it to us on a silver platter. It's because people who they said were crazy and stupid and dumb and, you know, like all of the other, you know, things that they'd thrown around, those people worked for decades and decades and decades, right? They collected these huge collections. They, you know, wrote all of these books and now they're, you know, on our shelves and, you know, we probably haven't picked them up in, you know, in a while, depending on whether or not we're working on something. That we need them for. And I think it's really important to recognize those people's work. And I think that's something that's been really rewarding, just about being, you know, especially with my research partner has a different, you know, kind of base of knowledge than I do. Honestly, his is way, way deeper. He's been at it way longer than I have. And he has so much knowledge, you know, around some things. And I've, you know, kind of gotten, he's got like his PhD, right? And I've gotten my master's degree just by like digging into other sources. And one of the beautiful things has been that, you know, in our partnership, we've been able to kind of connect and kind of combined, you know this really well, you're really good. And I know this really well. And we kind of sync up and overlap. And there's some really magical things that can happen when you collaborate in that way. But one of the things that was really great with, you know, the work that we did together, Loose Threads, is that we were able to put the spotlight on some of these people, like Bob Exler, you know, like Timothy Good, right? Like these are people who, you know, they were kind of, I would say, meteoric in that they were prolific. They did a lot of work. They put a lot of skins on the wall, if you will. But it's one where, you know, we're in a what have you done for me lately sort of situation. And there's so many things that they put out there. There's so many things that they uncovered that we still have not gotten to the core of, that need to be dug into further. And I think that's one of the fun things we got to do with Loose Threads is to sort of tease those things out. And we were able to, you know, uncover a few things and make a few connections. But there was also a lot of meat on the bone. And it was really great to see other people start to look back at these old sources, especially people coming in. There were a lot of people who weren't really interested before 2017, or maybe they were interested, but they weren't invested in the same way they are, you know, today. And so you're now kind of saying, hey, here are these sources. They have good things to say too. Don't forget about these guys, right? Don't forget about, you know, these people who've been just like you, and have been doing this for a really long time. I think sometimes what happens is, as you know, when the people who are the best, the people who are the worst tend to flame out on their own. The people who are the best tend to get a little help, right, with that. And so you do find, you know, I like to say that the intelligence community has turned history into a game and they ruin the best players. And I think that that is something that we have to keep in mind. A lot of the people that we, you know, we like to not just disparage, but just sort of like ignore. Oh, you know, we've heard about that. That you, I guarantee you, if you go back to those old sources and you give them another look at, right? Just look at them again. You will find there's so many things that are happening today that are connected, right, to the things that they were looking at then. And so I just want to, you know, I think that ufology is here to stay. I don't know what we're going to call it. But I think if, you know, it seems like there's a cohort of people who want sort of like a new group of experts, I'll say, so-called experts. And I don't think that's what the phenomenon is for. I don't think the phenomenon is for experts. I think it thwarts expertise. And I think that, you know, the issue is that you can only have expertise in a domain that is established and understood with established rules and norms and, you know, that has frameworks and theories and things like that. And so what happens when you have something that comes in, it just blows up all of those theories, right? That seems right. Like almost that's what it does, is it sort of forces you to say your framework does not work for this. And so I do think it's great to have science coming in and more people that are interested in this and bringing all that together. But I do think we need to make sure that we don't forget that, you know, what we know about UFOs today primarily comes from ufologists, and it primarily comes from experiencers, and ufologists have been the people who have been engaging with experiencers for a long period of time. And they're not all created equal, but there's certainly a rich history there. And I just want to encourage people, like, dust off those books, go to used bookstores. And, you know, if you see something that looks really weird and hokey, grab that one. I guarantee you will find some gold in there. So that's been a really big joy of mine, is to pour through those old books. And there's so many that I have that I haven't gotten to read. I've just gotten to skim, that I'm really looking forward to be able to just sit and take a few, you know, take a couple of days and just take my time with them and enjoy them. So thanks for asking that. Sorry, I went a little long on that one, but it's an area that I'm passionate about. So I appreciate that.
Oh, absolutely. I totally get it. We'll be right back after this quick break. You know, as you're talking about that, you know, talking about the idea of like the history of ufology is in, or even, you know, the nature of the phenomenon, all these things are intensely difficult to study. Because I think that even though, you know, everybody on UFO Twitter wants to talk about psyops and disinformation agents and all of that, I think that most people really underestimate the extent to which the intelligence community isn't just infiltrated into the community, but in a lot of ways is the community. Like, yeah. Like there are more of them than there are of us.
Yeah.
Like I remember actually when Whitley offered me this gig, he said some very nice things to me, but at the end he said, and I'm pretty sure you're not intelligence.
Pretty sure. 98%, right?
Right. And yeah, so how do you navigate getting to the truth when there are so many people in the field that we know are, you know, members of the intelligence community and therefore are, can't truly be said to be disinterested, unattached third parties. And then there's even more people who are involved who are in IC that are not identifying themselves in that way. And like, how do you put those pieces, even just begin to put the pieces together in like the work that you do? Because I know that it's like, it's extraordinarily complicated and it's crazy making, right? Like it's very difficult to understand what's going on from one minute to the next.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a real struggle. But you know what? If you can figure out how to not take it personally, right? If you're lucky enough to be able to be in that position, let's say, it's fun. It is a game. It's a game. And they're good. They're real, real good. And so I think a lot of times where we get in trouble is when we I think sometimes it is our act. It actually is our source. It's looking for truth, right? We're always looking for truth. And I think that really what we need to do is just take in that information and from, you know, all the sources, especially the sources you trust, the sources you don't trust, the people you like to listen to, the people you don't like to listen to, and just see what's there. And, you know, this has been a problem for, you know, for people in the UFO community forever. I mean, they're always getting information. They're always people who are very eager to tell them the things that they want to hear and very eager to tell them the things that they don't want to hear. And I think that, you know, it does feel pretty surreal sometimes to almost see people like basically arguing over which intelligence community official they believe, right? This guy's the intelligence official you can trust, right? Take it to the bank. And this other one, they're disinfo, right? And it's like, you realize that even if that person is lying, it might be their job to lie. And it would be, you know, in some instances, there might be a good reason that person's lying, right? I don't want to demonize the intelligence community, right? There are good people that are there to protect us, and they do. And so I think it's hard. But if you're lucky enough to be in a position where you can reasonably not take it personally and just understand these are just people doing their jobs, right? If they're lying, it's probably because they have to, you know, for most of them, then you can start to peel it back. Because I think even some of the people who do lie probably want to get out. I think there are people who are in the community and probably do tell a large percentage of truth. And maybe there's a percentage here or there that they have to, you know, they've got to deny, they've got to say some outright lies about. And, you know, it's so hard for us in our mind to say, liar, you know, like if they did that, that's a lie. It's, you know, that's the way the intelligence community works. If you want to hear from people who've actually worked in these areas, if your level of discourse is either you give me 100% unfiltered truth or not, then you're not in this space. You're not going to do well out here because that's not the way they work. And so, you know, the other thing though, is I'll say, I don't engage with people very much. I do tend to stick with published works. You know, I've done a few interviews and talked to a few people, and I do learn some interesting things from time to time. But mostly I find that you're just talking in circles. You realize that a lot of times the utility of it is, okay, I've got a hypothesis. I've got something that I think could be something. I'm going to just zing it at this person. And I'm going to see, especially if you're in a Zoom call like this, let's just see what their face does, right? Like, let's see if I can get some nervous laughter, if I can get some giggles, like, right? What can I get? And sometimes you'll get anger, right? Sometimes all of a sudden the tenor and tone of the conversation will change. And now they're almost like trying to talk down to you. Like, oh, you're an idiot. You don't know anything. And you're like, whoa, what did I say? All I did was ask about this question. And now all of a sudden you don't like me. And it's not even related to you. It's just about just sort of like a hypothesis. So there's some of that, that can be beneficial. But I think if you're finding that you're on like a text message basis relationship with these people, and I say these people, I don't want to do that, that's not right, but like with people who are involved in the intelligence community, then you're probably too close, right? That's not to say like you can be friends with people like that, it is what it is, but if they become your arbiter of reality and you have that kind of a close relationship, it's going to be hard not to trust them but to trust yourself, you know. And I think that in my opinion, if you rely on the open source, just put their statements out there. And if you take their statements that they made a month ago and today and 2 years ago and that they're going to make tomorrow on a podcast, and you put them up together, and then you take this guy who they say is disinfo, let's take his statements, let's put those up on the wall together. And then that guy over there who says that UFOs are BS, let's put his stuff on the wall. And you just kind of look at all this stuff, and it is kind of like a cheesy loose threads, right? It could become like this where you are kind of making these associative connections, and you just see what happens. And a lot of times they are really good at their jobs, but as much as they go and talk about the subject, they do make slip ups, right? And they don't always coordinate. They are human beings, and they really do rely on us being very binary thinkers. Like, that's the way they want it. They do not want people. They want you to either love them or hate them. They don't want you to be middle of the road. If you love them or hate them, they'll be your best friend, your worst enemy. They don't want to engage with you if you're actually going to look at just, if you're actually going to look at their statements and you're going to actually remember those and keep those. And you're also going to look at the other statements from the people that they're supposed to be enemies with. You can't be friends with the good cops and the bad cops. That's not allowed, right? That's not going to fly. And so, they don't want that. And so you need to be careful, at the same time, but if just stick open source, I really do. I think that everybody would be better off. You'd be safer. Stick open source, go to the archives, read the books, right? And you will find so much. There's so much meat on the bone. And we've got so many talented researchers and investigators that are on UFO Twitter, that are on Facebook, that aren't on any of the social media apps that are out there. And you do yourself a disservice when you start cutting off all of these other information, things. Well, they said this one thing I don't like, so now I'm never going to listen to that person again. Well, before long, it's going to be you and one other angry person on a podcast with two listeners, right? And, we're on a Twitter space. That's literally what we're doing. We hate stovepiping. We stovepipe ourselves, right? It's like, well, this is the stovepipe of the people who believe in the mummies, right? That's over here, right? For mummy pilled, you get to be in this space. You hate the mummies. You're not in with our group anymore. So if you hate mummies, you can be on the space at 3 a.m., right? And then it's just sort of like it's literally that. It gets that granular where you get down to where you're really, it's just like you and three people. And boy, we've made their job really easy for them, haven't we? When we do that. Sometimes you need to cut ties with people. Stop burning bridges. Just like, you don't have to have an opinion. You don't have to state an opinion about every single statement that, someone's made. Just like, be quiet and listen a little bit. And just let that information come in and then just compare it. Just see where you get. It's a hard thing to do and a hard line to walk. But it's worth it. I think it is worth it. You'll have more fun too, because then you'll have more things to listen to, more things to read. You're not constrained to life. I can only read these two people, right? Because they're the people who have not somehow pissed me off or said something I don't agree with, right? That's my philosophy in terms of trying to stay safe, but also to make some progress and avoid some of those landmines.
Yeah, I agree. And I appreciate that so much, you making that point about how we stovepipe ourselves. I feel like doing this work has made me a much better thinker, and being a better thinker has made me a better person. Because I think that we've gotten to a place in this country, obviously a very divisive election yesterday, where it's not even that people disagree with each other. It's like they can't understand why, they can't even understand the person's reasoning. And then they end up filling in the blank with a bunch of ugliness without trying to even understand where people might be coming from. And you can't do that and be good at this job, because you have to listen to everybody, especially, people want to say this person's a disinfo agent, this person is a disinfo agent. But if you understand how the intelligence community works, then the people who are a certain number of the debunkers and a certain number of the, the pro disclosure people are almost certainly on the same team. And creating that conflict is a way to keep people from looking at certain information. I think that I've seen a lot of examples where I see some of the best information coming from debunkers. And I don't think that's, I think it's intentional. I think it's if you get them to say enough things that people will hate, then you can get them to say the truth and then no one will listen.
Right.
And that's a really strange thing to observe. And I also think, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think you're right there. I mean, I think of it as poisoning the well, right? Mm-hmm. I've talked about, I call it intel laundering. Other people said, no, it's like when you're dirtying the laundry. It's not like cleaning the laundry. It's like, yeah, but it's like it's almost like you're taking, so like if you have a piece of sensitive information, right? And you know that this piece of sensitive information is very sensitive, right? And if it gets out and it's something that's actionable and it's, got some weight to it, it's going to be a problem. So what if I were to give it to somebody who just by saying it will discredit it for me? Well, now it just becomes part of whatever narrative they had going, you know, in the first place. And if somebody is digging into it, now it doesn't matter, right? If a document comes out that says that, people just go, oh, yeah, that was part of, you know, oh, that was part of the Serpo thing, right? Like, we all know that that wasn't, right? Oh, that was part of MJ-12. That was all debunked. I heard about that, right? Like, and so that's the way this works, right? They want to get you to land and be really sure about something. And then it gets blown up, right? And inevitably, and any of the details also get blown up too. And they trust that you, being a binary thinker, right, you're going to move on, right? You're going to say, I'm gone. Or you're going to double down and say, no, I know it's the truth. I am not leaving. I know that this mummy is the mummy, right? Like I will not move on, but I will die on this hill, right? This particular mummy named John, this is the mummy. That's the one, right? And so they want you to marry yourself to that, right? And all the details, or they want you to break away, right? And they don't want you to look at all the other things that were kind of attached to it. And so I feel that's one of the most beneficial things. That's one of the ways they use the UFO community. In my opinion, they use us as they kind of do their work for them. And so it's just human nature, right? Like it's not like they have to, you know, get us to make every move. Like they just know humans are going to human. If we give them this, they're probably going to human with this too, right? So let's just kind of float this out there. And sometimes, you know, people will ask them about something and, you know, maybe all they need to do is not make a statement about it. Maybe they, you know, they know I don't have to make it. I don't have to affirm it. I don't have to deny it. They'll read into that, right? And that's all I need to do. And I do think there's also this other weird thing where if you get in too deep, right? If you want to be involved in certain programs and certain work, you have to do it as a clown, right? There, that you almost have to pay your dues, right? That you have to basically, you've got to do something. You've got to get yourself affiliated with something that will make you somewhat disreputable, right? So that you can continue, especially if you're already out in the open and you want to be involved in the work. You cannot do that and be a person who is taken seriously. And so there, there are some people that we know and love, like we all love, that I guarantee you have already, or if they haven't, will soon, if they get reeled in further to other things as these projects get ramped up or revamped, you'll see them start endorsing things. You're like, really? You're going to be, you're with Mummy John too? Like they're going to do these things. And you're going to be like, how did that happen? And then you're thinking, maybe the mummy's real. And it's like, no, just backpedal a little bit. Just let it all play out. They're just doing their dues, right? They're paying their dues. They have to do this. It's part of the job. You know, if I've got something, you know, in my tent back here that I don't want anyone to look at, right? I'm going to paint it with stripes. I'm going to put a clown in front. Right? They'll think it's a circus. If they're not interested in the circus, they're going to keep walking. And so in my opinion, if you're going to get involved, and when I say you, sometimes I might mean you, like especially people that are on, you know, text message basis with a lot of intelligence community members, you are going to join the circus. That will be the price of entry. And it's the same price that a lot of the UFO people that you now call, you know, oh, this grifter and these hoaxers and this guy, well, you know, we can't listen to anything from any of the early contactees. They were all hoaxers and grifters. They've been doing, right? So they've literally gotten you to ignore all of those, right? Basically people who were engaging with the phenomenon the same way we all try and do today. They're trying to learn all of this information. Some of them did perpetrate hoaxes and were grifters. There's no doubt about it. But they kind of get us to paint with a broad brush. And, you know, in doing so, we're kind of just perpetuating that. And then eventually you'll join the circus too. right? And you'll hope that everybody will forget that you, you know, you went along with this thing or you believed that thing, you made this mistake or that mistake, you believed this person, or you didn't believe that person. It's, you know, it becomes this kind of purity culture thing.
Yeah.
And we just won't make progress that way. And I promise you, bringing in the experts, it'll be the same thing. They will also join the circus. Some of them already have. They will come in and they will join the circus too. And that'll be really fun, won't it? Right? Like, that'll be really fun. If you're already, I don't take myself seriously. And so I already kind of consider myself, you know, a clown. If I knew how to juggle, I mean, I don't know, maybe there's good money in it. I have not looked into what the exchange rates are for, you know, the clown economy. So I'm not really sure. I'm not sure how much money there is in it, but if it's good money, I'm fit for it. So I, you know, don't take yourself too seriously. Don't be worried about being wrong. You know, like, you're going to be wrong. You are wrong right now about a million things that you don't realize. You're wrong about things you do realize and you just don't want to admit.
Right.
You're wrong about stuff. Get over it. You're going to make mistakes. Join the circus. You know, it's fine. It's fine. You know, it's fun.
It is
people
fun.
People hate it for the circus.
We'll be right back after this quick break. That was a great point. Yeah, I mean, I think you're seeing a lot of that happen right now, especially since 2017. You know, there are, you know, these other experts kind of stepping into the ring. Something that I find amusing at this point is whenever I'm watching, you know, a documentary or a new UFO show, and we're getting a ton of new ones right now, that, like, you know, these people will give their origin story, right? Like, this is how I got involved in this, you know, and they're all, the origin stories are almost always a lie. And they're like a demonstrable lie where they've said things publicly or records exist or, you know, whatever, that, like, they're like, and that's the first time I ever heard that idea. And it's like, really? Because you were briefing members of Congress on it 25 years ago. So that was the first time? Like,
yeah.
I mean,
it was personal interest the whole time, right? It's been personal interest for 7 decades, right? My entire life.
Or they swear they don't know each other, but, like, you know, they were all at the NIDS meeting in, you know, 1996,
right.
1997 or something. It's like, come on, man.
They worked together at McDonnell Douglas in 1973. Yeah, but
they're like, never heard of him. And like you said, I mean, I think that there's reasons for those stories. And I think that, like, not all of them are necessarily nefarious.
Right.
But you do have to be, but if you're able to kind of follow as many of the various threads as possible without getting too invested in it, you can sort of see a more complex picture begin to emerge, which is something, like, you definitely did really masterfully with Loose Threads. Would you, without giving too much away, I really think people should read it. I think it's a really, really important work. But, you know, what are the, can you just talk a little bit about some of the connections that you found from, like, these older groups of people who, many of whom are just, like, enthusiasts who got really deep into this stuff, who are still kind of shaping the story today? Because I think a lot of people don't realize how far back a lot of this goes.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of interesting. You know, there are a lot of things that have been asserted for many years that most people are now acknowledging. And because, you know, one or another person said them. Well, this person says that, you know, they're downing saucers. Did you know that? It's like, yep. Do you know that? Sorry, because all the people that you won't listen to, we will listen to, right? We read those books. And what's almost funny is a lot of times those people, right, that maybe were writing in the 80s and 90s, they're actually listening to other people, right, even earlier. And so, like, one of the things that came out in Luis Elizondo's books was, you know, Roswell, right? You know, they're like, oh, did you know the Roswell, they said, was actually... you know, maybe came from an electromagnetic pulse that might have actually been a grab. We covered that in Loose Threads, right? That and actually used that particular case to talk about that. But, you know, we just used a document, right? The Guy Hoddle memo, where they kind of talk about that there were these, you know, discs that came down and that it was a high powered form of radar. You know, and that's actually come out even some, I don't remember who it was, but someone reported about, oh, you know, that it might have actually been high-powered radar. And so these are things, these are documents that have been out there, right? And they are, you know, a lot of times you'll pick up these old books like Clear Intent, right? Something like that, and you'll open it, and they're there, in there, buried in there. Or like, if you've read any, if you've read William Steinman's, you know, The UFO Crash at Aztec, right? So many documents are there, and you can Google them and still find them that way. But there are some that are pretty hard to find. But you're reading those older books, you will find these documents that do have these references that now are starting to be like, you know, they're actually being talked about in the news. You know, these concepts of things that, you know, and I'll just say it, Stephen Greer has been talking about all of it, all of it. And I'm not here to tell you that you should trust Stephen Greer or that he's, you know, beyond reproach, but I'm not going to sit here and, you know, sell you down the river and tell you that you should just ignore him because, you know, he dropped some flares, or maybe, I don't know, like maybe he did that. Maybe he, I don't know all the things, but I do know if you read his books and further, if you listen to some of the witnesses that he's, you know, that he's, been able to bring in over the decades, you know, people talk to the guy. That, I mean, what can you say? People talk to the guy. And, you know, I think that there is something, there's something to that. There is a utility to that. And so even if you don't like the message, even if you don't like, even if you hate the messenger, right, you may want to look at some of that stuff. There's so much in Loose Threads that really does come from, hey, yeah, actually, it's not Tom DeLonge. It's actually that Tom DeLonge listened to Stephen Greer, that was like hanging out with Stephen Greer at his house. Most of the things that Tom DeLonge says, Stephen Greer said first. And I, that will be, I don't, I'm probably going to anger people, but that's just, I think Tom would probably willingly admit that. And, you know, and I think we should also look at, and I'm not here to do Stephen Greer apologetics, although it seems like I am, you know, there are other things that have, like, even recently, I think there was a story where they actually said, yeah, some of the whistleblowers did come from Stephen Greer. And some of them were actually legitimate, that some of them were not, obviously, and some of them were. And that's where it kind of comes from, that binary mindset where, you know, we want to say anybody who is attached to the name Stephen Greer, right, I'm not going to listen to. That is a very stupid way of doing research, okay? Because that's like everyone. There's all of our favorite journalists at one point were hanging out with Stephen Greer. Like, you may not like that, but that's just the way it is. And so, you know, and he's not the only one, right? Like, even going back, like, one of the books I like to talk about is The Flying Saucers Have Landed. Okay. This is a book that was written, by, Adamski, right? In, it came out in 1953. All right. He wrote like two or three chapters at the end. And if you don't know who Adamski is, I'm blanking on his name because it's late for me. I think George Adamski, I think.
He was one of the
And, you know, so he was sort of early contacting movement in the early 50s and, you know, kind of people who were interacting with Venusians, right? That was kind of like the,
Space Brothers.
Yeah, the Space Brothers, and, you know, they were doing a lot of the same kind of stuff that we do today, you know, like just some different terminology, they're wearing different kinds of clothes and things like that. It's very sci-fi, right? But they're having the same kinds of experiences that people have had ever since. They really are. And, you know, George Adamski, you know, I would not debate that he probably perpetrated some hoaxes, right? He probably did try and use some dubious information. But I will say, like, for instance, that book that he wrote, there's another person he wrote it with, his name's Desmond Leslie. And boy, if you go through, this is 1953, Desmond Leslie is in there talking about that the UFOs like nukes. Isn't that interesting? Right. These are connections, right? That like other people, like later, you know, Arthur Hastings. Man, I'm getting my fields. Are we talking about parapsychologists over here? But, you know, people would go and write these books, amazing books about UFOs and nukes. We talked about UFOs and nukes. And imagine my surprise after writing Loose Threads, right? Talking about, you know, using nuclear weapons and things like that to actually bait UFOs and debate the phenomenon in, that was something that we covered, that, you know, they noticed those trends. And they were talking about them in this book in 1953, right? This book that's written by, you know, co-authored by George Adamski. And so there are all sorts of things in those kinds of books that would just stun you, like the kinds of things that are today, you know, are like latest news, are things that they were talking about very freely back then. But we don't look at that anymore because they're hoaxers, right? Like, because if it's affiliated with that, if we see that kind of thing, we know it must be complete garbage. And so that really does, that kind of goes back to our original point of just opening up the aperture and just, no, yeah, you're going to catch a lot of garbage. There's no doubt about it, right? There's no history, by the way, where that's not the case. It's not like the UFO subject is different. It's just, you know, it's just easier later on to, in hindsight, to go back. But there are a lot of things like that. So, you know, we talked about baiting the phenomenon with UFOs. We also talked about baiting the phenomenon with experiencers. That's something that people still don't want to talk about. Okay. It's something that, you know, if you go on and you try and have that conversation with, you know, your intelligence community podcast guests, right? Don't talk about it a little bit. They don't want to go really deep there. And, right. And so those are the things that make us like, yeah, let's start digging into that, right? Let's see if we can find these public statements and these references to these kinds of things. But yeah, I mean, there are a lot of signs, even in those early, you know, areas. I mean, like Nick Redfern, for instance, he wrote a book called Final Events, and they're talking about how they were embedded, right? They had people embedded from the CIA and from AFOSI, from the Air Force Office of Special Investigation, that they were embedding themselves with the early contactee movement, right?
Right.
So this has been going on for a very long time, right? This idea of why are they spending so much time around experiencers, right? Why are they coming on our podcast? They've been coming on our podcast, right? It's so to speak, since at least 1952, 1953, right? It probably before. And so, you know, these are trends that are, you know, for people who are your listeners, it probably is just an afterthought to them. But I would encourage them, even if that's not in the news to them, they should be curious about that. Like, why, right? Why is this the case? And what are all the reasons why they might be looking at the UFO community? And there are people who have made statements about those things, you know, throughout the years. Collect those statements. Find what are they saying? What are they telling people? You know, like some people say, well, they're worried that it might be the Russians or the Soviets back in the day. So they keep track of the UFO community to make sure, you know, to spread disinfo to the Russians and to see what the Russians know, you know, but about conventional stuff. It has nothing to do with UFOs. Okay, just file that away, right? Like, you don't have to get upset about it. Say, okay, sure. Like, file that away and then see what the next person says about it, right? Oh, well, it's because, you know, we're worried that they might have, you know, photographed something that has to do with a new aircraft that we're doing. So now that's why we're following. Okay, cool. So you, right, just collect all that stuff in. But I'll be honest with you, there is not a thing that has come out that has not already been out in many books, not just Loose Threads. It's just that certain people are saying it. And I will say that, you know, that to me, David Grush, like if you're asking me if I've got to like rank them, it's like there's the person who went before Congress that I know went under oath, and then there's everybody else. That's my position. That will not make me popular with everybody. But to me, and I'm looking forward to these hearings to people who are going to come out next, I like that he went under oath. I trust him now a lot more because I know he's got at least some skin in the game. That he went before somebody and, you know, held up his hand and, you know, I don't know how much of that is theater, right? If it's found out that he actually did lie about something or they're going to do, I don't know, but he did that, right? He went in, he followed the protocol. He's an official whistleblower. And I think it's amazing. So I root for him. I really do because like, if he's, to me, if you're doing that, maybe you're wrong about something, but you're not lying probably, right? For the best of what you know, you're putting that out there. And so I hope that more of the people who've been talking to us on podcasts and things like that, if they can, I hope that they're going to show up, you know, in this next hearing. And I know there's always talk of, well, they've done this behind the scenes. That's great. I don't know that. Right. We talked about baiting. Sorry, I'm getting off track here. That's what I do. That's how we write. You're going to fall down rabbit holes.
Well, there's some ways to go with all this stuff for sure.
That's right. That's right. But yeah, we talk about baiting. We talk about, studying experiencers as well, right? So baiting with experiencers, studying experiencers, has been a good deal of that going on. Probably a lot of it still ongoing. We talk about some other figures that really even still have not broken into the public conversation. So people like Bobby Ray Inman, right, is one of our big focuses. If you don't know who Bobby Ray Inman is, he is somebody who was the second in command, let's say, or close to second in command at the CIA. He was the director of the NSA. He was director of Naval Intelligence. He was the second in command of DIA. He was all of those things. Okay. He's a pretty big deal. And there are a lot of things that he did that are, had a huge impact on the intelligence community. And there have been people who have associated him with UFOs. And there was a recorded conversation that happened in 1989, I believe it was, between himself and Bob Exler, in which he seemed to intimate that he was knowledgeable about crash retrieval operations. Okay. And sure enough, he pointed Bob Exler to a few other people. And at least one of those people seemed to also be knowledgeable about UFO crash retrieval operations, and seemed to take the fact that this person said that Bobby Ray Inman sent him as permission, that it was okay to talk about this. Bobby Ray Inman is very old, but he is still with us. And I think recently someone asked Chris Mellon if they had reached out to him. And Chris Mellon said that, yes, they had reached out to him, but that he didn't offer anything of help. But even Mellon kind of said, surprisingly, I think I'll have to pull out the quote. I don't want to misquote him, but I think the idea was that, surprisingly, yes, he did not give us much, right? I will say this. If you like to follow the people that we follow, which is sort of like the Invisible College, right? Mm-hmm. So Jacques Vallée, Kit Green, Hal Putoff, we talk about Colonel John Alexander a lot. I'm sure he's not a fan of loose threads, but we love him. We follow him closely, big fan. And, it is one where they don't talk about Bobby Ray Inman, except when they talk about Bobby Ray Inman, right? Because that was the big thing that came out. One of the big things that came out is that there was this group called the Advanced Theoretical Physics Working Group. And this was actually Colonel John Alexander's kind of passion project, where he had people, meeting at a SCIF and, members of the intelligence community, people who were affiliated with different defense contractors like McDonnell Douglas and Lockheed Martin, kind of coming together and let's put our heads together and see what we can do. Maybe we can do something together, sort of a joint research and development group. And at the first meeting, it seems that Bobby Ray Inman's name came up in connection with a major engineering project that was in some notes that leaked from those meetings. And the person whose notes those notes belong to has said that did happen, even after the fact when John Alexander said that it didn't happen. And so if you look at, you want to look at Jacques Vallée's journals, let's say, and you want to look for, a particular member of the intelligence community, especially like prominent figures, you'll find them all. You will find references to all of these guys. You will not find any references to Bobby Ray Inman. To some people, they will look at that and say, that seems like maybe he wasn't important. To me, I look at that and I say, that seems to me like maybe he is important, because it's astonishing that they wouldn't be talking about him all the time. Well, apparently they were talking about him, but he doesn't make it into any of these, kind of compendiums. They don't And it almost makes it seem like maybe they were careful not to include him in some of these things. And so he's someone who I think ought to be paid attention to. I think they ought to zing some questions at him. There are some people, I know some people who have emailed him some questions. And, you know, there are some people who even gotten interviews with him and things like that. And they've tried to question him on it. And, you know, he's somebody to look at. And there are a lot of these guys that are older and are still alive. And, you know, these are the kinds of people who should show up in hearings, too. You know, put them under oath. Let them lie under oath. Like, that's
right.
They've done it before, I'm sure. And maybe they don't know anything. But they can sure help. I can tell you that. They can sure help. Just based on the basis of their knowledge. And so those were kind of the threads that we really pulled on. We're looking at the Invisible College, looking at some of these, you know, some of these earlier attempts to sort of dig into where are these programs? How can we get involved in these programs? You know, with the Invisible College, and then looking at some of these figures, not because it's all about them, but just because they're a really convenient person to dive into the story. Right. You know, that's for us, like you look at someone like Colonel John Alexander. It's not that everything revolves around Colonel John Alexander. It's just he's a really convenient place to jump in because he talks to everybody. He connects to everything, right? We may not realize this, but if you look at what he's been doing and you look at like all the people that he's known, you will connect to like the entire, like the whole UFO story, right? If you're willing to kind of fall down those rabbit holes. And so he's almost a narrative device, if you will, right? You can use him as an entry point, or you can use his group as an entry point. Or you could go to NIDS and say, oh, that's going to be my entry point. Or you could go to OSAC, right? And there are a lot of people that's their entry point. But I think the key is, can you keep following it, right? Can you follow it? Because we always want to follow it forward, but we never end up following it back, right? And you start to see where the seed of some of these different ideas, these concepts, these programs, where do those things actually come from? And boy, the more you look, it just keeps going further and further back, as I'm sure you know. And it's fun. It really is so fun. So if you haven't checked out Loose Threads, it is free. So I'm not asking you to pay for that. That's I'm sure you can share the link out to that. But
yeah,
you can go to my Twitter page and check it out. It's just a free PDF. And there's a lot of meat left on the bone there for sure. So lots of stuff to dig into if you like to dig.
Yes, absolutely. We'll definitely have that linked up in the episode notes. And I really can't recommend it enough. It was, for me, it was a game changer. It like opened it gave me enough history to start really digging and to start understanding some of this stuff more. So I recommend it all the time and I can't recommend it enough. Well, it looks like we have come to the end of the public portion of the show. For anybody who's listening now, Daniel, do you want to let people know where to find you and your work online?
Yeah, if really the best place to find me is on Twitter or X, if that's what you call it. That is what it's called. But if you call it Twitter, you're good with me, too. My handle is Omega Point. It's got a zero, but you can find me just by searching Daniel Elizondo with an E. And you'll find a link out in my pinned tweet to my Medium page where you can find some blog posts and things like that.
Perfect. That's great. And I'll make sure that's all linked up. For members of Unknown Country, we will be continuing on for another half an hour. I'm going to be asking Daniel some really fun questions about another big piece of the puzzle with the secrecy around UFOs, which is about human potential. So we'll be continuing on. If you'd like to hear that conversation and you are not a member, you can sign up at unknowncountry.com. All right. So something I'm really excited about is the docuseries for my company is coming out soon. We're going to be announcing the name soon. We had to change it for anyone who's been following along with this saga. But Daniel is featured prominently throughout all three episodes. So you guys will get to hear a lot more from Daniel, which I'm excited about. And, you know, one of the conversations that I was really excited to have you speak on in the show and something that we got a chance to talk about at dinner, which was a really fun conversation, is just this idea that there's the secrecy around UFOs. But once you kind of dig into all of this, it's not that the UFO secrecy is like there aren't UFOs there. Obviously, we're talking about crash with people and all these other things. but that there's something else behind that, that in some ways might actually be more core to the actual question, which is secrecy around human potential. Mm-hmm. And I know that's like a big prompt that I'm just, it's a big question, but can you talk a little bit about like what you see that connection being between human potential and the secrecy around UFOs?
Yeah. I think that they're almost, you cannot separate the two, in my opinion. I think when I would have started writing and everything, I would have said, yeah, they're probably related. But I have not found many cases. I've not found many, even researchers and scientists who are involved with one without somehow being involved in the other or connected to in some way the other. And by the other, I mean, you mentioned human potential. So, you know, you could talk about things like ESP, so parapsychology, psychoenergetics, psychotronics, which was, more kind of combining, psychoenergetics, but like with electronics and things like that. So it's a very Soviet thing at the beginning, I would say. There's also different kinds of contact modalities as well, right? Ways to reach out to non-human intelligences, right? So sometimes that might be through like a CE5, might be channeling, might be, even using like talking boards and Ouija boards and things like that, right? That can be a contact modality. One of the interesting things, I was even looking back at one of the earliest reports, kind of like kicked off the airship waves. Okay. Which is sort of like blimps and Zodiac kinds of things, right? That were floating around. I think it was in the 1800s, right?
It was 1896 or 97. I'm obsessed with the
airship. It's like the first, the first recognized case, they talked about that they were talking to somebody, that they could hear voices, right? And so when I heard that, the first time I heard that, I was actually reading that book I referenced earlier. It was Out of the Stars, which was a book written by a colleague of George Van Tassel's, who was talking about trying to find a place in the Mojave Desert called Giant Rock, okay? And he is trying to find it. He doesn't know where it's at because it's literally just a giant rock, right? It's not actually on the map, especially at that point in time. So he's out at Joshua Tree trying to find directions. And all of a sudden he starts hearing audible voices in his head telling him, go right, go left, right? And so I kind of made that association between those two cases, like, oh man, they heard voices, right? Like they heard voices, like that can mean so many things. But it, you know, the association between especially ESP, especially telepathy, and the phenomenon are, I can't even separate the two things. Most listeners to your show, that's not news. You have to wonder, where does that come from? Does it start with you already have maybe a little bit of human potential going, like you've got something special about you, and then that's what kind of attracts them to you? Or is it something that maybe after your interactions, now something is sort of, something happens, as we look at the brain and plasticity, there's something called, entrainment, right? Where you can sort of create these psi conducive states, right? Based on, particular inputs or stimuli. So sometimes it might be lights, right? Like flashing lights. So audio visual entrainment, right? You can download an app and then you can flash a strobe in your face. And as long as you don't have epilepsy, right, you should be able to do that safely, and you can kind of get a little bit of a a meditative state, right? It'll get some alpha rhythms going for you, obviously there's binaural beats, monaural beats, isochronic tones, and things like that. But that's just like one piece of the puzzle. All of that stuff is in like the earliest contact contactee like stories. Like even, you know, if you want to go back to the Betty and Barney Hill case, right? They heard beeps, right? They heard beeps in a very weird frequency. They saw flashing red lights. That's something that the Soviets were looking at. They were looking at flashing. They were looking at red lights. They used that in the Ganzfeld experiments, right? They use red lights. The Ganzfeld experiments are a parapsychological experimental design, right? Where you put halved ping pong balls on your eyes and they shine a low intensity red light kind of over you. And it helps to sort of give you a, sensory deprivation effect, right? And, you know, and that's supposed to help if you are a telepathic receiver, that's supposed to help, right, with that. So there's just, it's hard for me, especially now, once you see the connection, especially between entrainment and psychoconducive states, you look at a UFO contact experience, right? There's a lot of it. There's a lot of it. And, you know, even if you want to go back to Antonio Villaboas, like there's mists, there's a lot of mists and sprays and things like that. And so you even have maybe some chemical things that are happening there as well. And so, you know, some people will look at that and say, well, then maybe it's just all hallucination, but they don't understand that there's this whole very rich history of research around putting people into, you know, these states. And over time, states become traits. The longer you spend in an altered state of consciousness, you will start to take on that trait, which might be actually problematic, right, for some groups in the government. They may want to be able to put someone in a state to do something, but they also do not want that person to become Ram Dass, right? Like Ram Dass is probably not going to, help you fight your intelligence war with the Russians, right? Like, and so there's this, it's interesting to see this kind of back and forth between, we need the paranormal performance, right? We need this reliable, high-tech paranormal performance. That's what we need. But we also need people who will use their abilities, right, to do things that we want them to do. And how can we get one, right? How can we get this piece where they're going to do what we need them to do, but they don't become Ram Dass? Like, how can we do that, right?
Right.
I find that that particular kind of chasing down those pieces, will land you in a lot of weird places. So you'll start looking into human engineering. You'll start looking into human performance. There are a lot of very mundane sounding things that you wouldn't, you know, stress. Like there's a lot of stress research. How to, you know, what happens when, you know, somebody sees these lights flashing in front of them? Will they be able to, you know, do things? Will they still be able to perform under those conditions? What happens if someone's vibrating really fast? Like there's a lot of very mundane sounding research that's sort of this dual purpose research. Yeah, it's such a fascinating connection there.
Yeah, it really is. I appreciate what you said about, you know, like once you start seeing these connections, it's hard to unsee them. Like even as you were talking, I was just rereading one of Keel's essays earlier today, and we're talking specifically about like people getting hit with like a reddish light in the course of.
Of course, that is so special.
Oh, encounter, and that happens all the time.
Let me mention this because I feel like your listeners will appreciate this. So I was the other day actually reading about that book that I just told you about, the giant rock thing. Okay. And I have a child who's five, and, you know, I've got a studio out here in the backyard, and he's out there playing, doing his thing. And right as I'm there, like, and he's talking about, you know, I think it was him talking about getting to giant rock, but it's like right when I see the word giant rock, my five-year-old jumps onto this porch out here, right? You've got a door and a window, and he holds up a rock and says, "Daddy, look, I found a giant rock." Like, as I'm reading this guy telling me about this string of synchronicities that led him here, and that's such a common experience. That's the kind of thing, again, that you see and you can't unsee it. And it's personal. And it won't, that alone won't turn you into Ram Dass, right? But it seems to accompany the kinds of experiences and looking into the kinds of experiences that do turn people into figures like that. And so I think that it's, it's just so, it's so weird. And I love it. You know, like, I love that. And of course I had to go, I'm like, what were you doing? Like, what are you doing? He's like, oh yeah, I'm drawing pictures of these rocks. And he's like, been out in the backyard drawing pictures of rocks and like cataloging them. I don't know. It's, but he decided to do that. And I was like, okay, so where did I tell you to find the rocks? He's like, no, you didn't tell me. I was like, okay. I was trying to make sure I didn't tell him, go find a big rock and show it to me. But it just, you know, what are, you know, if it's, you can't calculate the odds on something like that, but if you could, they would be astronomical. And so there's a lot of magic in our everyday lives, right? And a lot of times, once you see it, you can't unsee it, right? Like, that's the thing. There's sometimes we're always looking for these extraordinary events and all of the things around those. And it's like, there's extraordinary events happening all the time in your own life. And, you know, you don't have to let, you can be engaged with this subject and still lean into the mystery of your own life. Like, that should be where it should take you, is further in, not away and out of relationship. I've got to like be an obsessive over here. I can't talk to anybody. Right. Like, just lean into it. And, yeah. Yeah. So I think there's a lot of human potential in that way too. Right. So not just our abilities, but also in, just our willingness to be human and to, like, you know, it made me want to, and I did, like, I want to go and play with my cute outside. I would put this book down, this weird book down of the go, and like, just play with my 5-year-old. Maybe that's what I need to do right now. And so anyway, that, I just couldn't get away from that without making that association, because I felt like, you know, maybe your listeners might appreciate that kind of little detail.
Yeah, no, moments like that are, like, they become, when you're doing this work, they become, like, just a regular occurrence, and yet there's a way in which, like, I will never get used to it. Like, there is...
That's right.
You know? And if anything, like, if I go for too long without having something totally weird like that happen, I feel like, am I even on the right track? Like, what do I...
That's right.
You know? Like,
yeah, it's like inviting a bell or something, right? I don't... There are people that will attribute a specific, you know, meaning, or I don't. I just think it's sort of like a tap on the shoulder, like, hey, what's up?
Great.
Well, reality is not what you think it is. Continue, right? Like, just whatever it is you're doing, just keep going.
Exactly. Exactly. I think what's really fascinating to me about the secrecy around the human potential stuff is how much it is in some ways stigmatized even more than UFO stuff. You know what I mean? Like, people can wrap their minds around, wrap their minds around the idea of, like, a non-human craft or technology, mm-hmm. or something like that. But I think that it's harder for people to grasp what a human being is capable of, because it seems as though, I mean, I know the way I used to think about it was, you know, if those sorts of things existed, well, I'm a human. Wouldn't I know about this? Mm-hmm. And so I just find that really fascinating, and how we've been kept from kind of knowing these things about ourselves, about what we're able to do. Like, the first time I ever, like, really tried remote viewing, and, like, I'm in danger to no one. I'm not a very good remote viewer. But the first time I did it and it, like, worked, you lose your mind. You're just like, what? The world is not what I thought that it was. And so, I don't know. I guess, what are your thoughts on why it is that they're so concerned? Like, why is this such a big secret? Like, why aren't we allowed to know? Just we are.
Because, yeah, that's a deep rabbit hole. But I think that in general, and it's a dangerous rabbit hole. I mean, to be honest, I mean, I think that there are pieces. I think it's very clear that a decision has been made somewhere with regard to remote viewing, that we're going to start being more open on it, because there are certain people who've been doing podcasts who are usually very, very guarded about programs that have been revealing new things that they've never before, that if you were to ask them 2 weeks ago, right? Like, hey, you know, did this happen? Like, for instance, Ed May not long ago said that they put remote viewers in space, that actually during the program that there were remote viewers put that in space. I can tell you for a fact that if you had asked Ed May that a month beforehand, he probably would have called you an idiot and talked, right, like, torn you apart and said, you need to stop listening to all these people. You know, you're a loony, you're a Looney Tunes. But he went out and said that, right? Mm-hmm. I asked somebody else about that and said, I don't, you know, who would have known? So like, oh yeah, like he said that. It was like, yeah. It was like, oh no, that didn't happen. Right. And so, but at the same time, like that's just one example, but there are lots of people who are going and talking very openly about remote viewing in particular. And it seems that there is some now, some openness to that. And so I do wonder, number one, I think the great part of that, even if there are certain people who definitely do not like the association between UFOs and remote viewing, it's because there is, and they know that there's going to be people that are surfacing those things. And so, you know, there's new interest, but also maybe there's a new openness to sort of throw people a bone, like, all right, sure. Stop digging, right? Like, I think there's that piece of it. I do also think though, that if you start digging beyond remote viewing, right. Which is, I'm not entirely sure it's a completely passive, especially when we know about, you know, what we know about, like we know about quantum mechanics, but, you know, the observation might be a creative act. And so you know, one wonders if, you know, you're remote viewing certain things that haven't been seen in a while or won't be seen for a while, that maybe there could be a connection there, a creative act. Right. It's mostly passive, right? But there are a lot of other things that, let's just say if the Soviets were trying it, the notion that we were trying it, I would disbelieve on the spot, right? Maybe the people who were doing the remote viewing weren't doing that. I guarantee you somebody else was.
Right.
And, you know, one way to get them really flustered and really upset with you is to start talking about other groups that were looking into remote viewing or looking into psychoenergetics that weren't them, right? Like at the same time. And that were involved with, you know, the Central Intelligence Agency and were involved with some of these other groups, maybe weren't funding them, but they were like, oh yeah, we are also funding this other group over here. And, you know, you wonder like, what is the extent of some of those things? So like, for instance, psychokinesis, right? Like that's that would be disruptive, pretty disruptive if somebody could do that. You know, there's a quote that that Jacques Vallée says in one of Forbidden Science journals where he says, you know, he's talking to Hal Puthoff and he says, you know, it may not be that the thing that may upset them, the reason why they may be worried, why they may be actually funding your work is because if Yuri Geller can fix von Braun's pocket watch, then he may be able to trigger a nuclear weapon. Okay. Mm-hmm. You may disbelieve Yuri Geller, right? And say, well, that guy's, you know, a huckster, a trickster, whatever, right? He's very much a trickster. But if that's possible, there is no amount of money that they would not spend on trying to find out if that were possible. Yes, for defensive purposes, obviously, but also for offensive purposes as well. You know, missile defense and these kinds of things, this is the like top, this is top level stuff for them. And so, and honestly, maybe for good reason, if it were possible that one of you or I like could become good enough at PK to trigger a nuclear weapon, that might be problematic. And I would, if you know me, I would at least well enough to know, I don't like advocating for secrecy. I'm like, no, you know, like we need to get out at the same. That's when we're like, okay, I understand why maybe it's not the best thing for everybody to know that because we are not responsible yet enough for that.
Right.
One wonders, will we ever be responsible enough? And is it one of those things that you just have to, you don't become responsible enough until you have to be? I don't know. Right. I also think there are probably ways to block it, you know, that I think that they wouldn't be talking, especially about the remote viewing piece. They 100% probably know how to block it or how to screen from it. I believe that. I don't have any evidence for it. I'm sure people would say he's dumb. He doesn't know what he's talking about. You're right. I don't. I'm just making an educated guess there that you wouldn't be talking openly about this capability now if you thought that it was maybe unsafe to do that. And so I think, you know, there probably is a way to screen or block some of these things, but I think there's also deeper things that you could look at as well. Kind of going back to that, you know, I mentioned the quantum piece there, you know, earlier, like what's the extent of that, right? Like, is it possible, you know, that there is a level of, you know, that there is a level of human potential that could be disruptive in a global way, right? I mean, there have been people like early contactee movements, you know, Andrija Puvarich, he had this thing called the Mind Link where they were trying to get people together. And they were, in a way, it was sort of like, you know, if you look at the monastics, they do something called praying the hours, right? Especially in the Western contemplative traditions, where they constantly, there's, you know, some monks somewhere, right, who are constantly praying for the world, right, in a way, which is kind of beautiful, even if you don't believe in that particular faith tradition. What if a bunch of people got it in their heads to do that? Like, we should all get it. Let's get an app together and all decide we're going to pray that the, you know, that everybody in the Middle East is just going to calm down, right? Like, that's what we're going to pray. Just knock it off. Everybody calm down. Let's see what happens. They were actually trying to do some of that stuff, you know, in the 70s. And you know, around that time, you know, Andrija Puvarich's house burned down, like, with people in it. They got out and no one died. But it seemed to have been a malicious event. At least that's the way they paint it. And, you know, a lot of the people that were involved, they feel like I saw an interview. I cannot remember her name. You might know who I'm talking about. But one of his, one of the people that he was working with at that time was there. They said they felt like they were being attacked, right? They almost got killed for meditating, right? And, I love that. Honestly, like, I love it. I think we need to start mind linking. Please don't burn my house down. You know, but I think there is something about that that is incredibly disruptive, even if it's not real, right? Like, what if just by having that intent, by saying we're going to come together and coalesce around, like, nonviolence or peace, that in itself is disruptive to institutional, you know, worn out context, like perseveration over these, like, worn out ideas that don't work anymore. And they rely on those things. And so if you get a group that's saying, hey, let's come, let's set aside even our faith traditions. Let's set aside our political differences. We all agree we don't want violence. Can we agree that? Okay, we can. All right, let's try and put some intention out there. Just that willingness to do that probably changes a person in a way that might be dangerous for institutions, right? And that I think there is a piece of that that is connected to human potential, maybe both human potentials, right? But they tend to go together. They really do tend to go together. And then there's this other piece where, right, is it possible that you could, you know, that maybe the reality around us is dependent on human potential and our own perceptions and our own observations more than we realize. And that's the kind of secret that, you know, there's somebody who knows that and they know it and it's theirs to play with and to manage. And they don't want to share that responsibility with everyone else. Yeah, I don't know. It's a really interesting area. And I hope that we learn more about it. And I do think that it is going to be a slippery slope. I think that UFOs, for better or worse, people are going to be looking into human potential. They are going to get involved with that. Although I do think it's very interesting that, like you said, that we do frame it as if the UFOs, that's the big thing. You know, that's the big key. That's, they don't want you to know about that. But human potential is, you know, just this side piece. It's very interesting, but it's not necessarily the big. To me, it's the most important piece because, you know, what am I going to do with a UFO sitting in a, you know, in a hangar somewhere? I mean, that's cool. You know, I want to know about it. Obviously I want to know about that, but, you know, I want to know what I can do and what does that mean for my life? And, you know, and it seems like this is very pertinent to us. And even with remote viewing, I think there's a thing where sometimes there's like, I feel like people get interested in that and then the interest drops off really quickly. I was actually reading, it was in the foreword of Leonid Vasilyev's book, which is, he was a Soviet parapsychologist, one of the earliest. He actually started working in the 20s and 30s. And he wrote a book called Experiments in Mental Suggestion. And in the foreword of that book, Arthur Hastings, who I referenced earlier when I was trying to talk about the other Hastings, he was telling an anecdote about somebody who learned that they could influence the behavior of somebody else, right? They were basically, what they were doing is thinking about somebody and trying to send out that they'll call them, right? They're on a trip. I haven't heard from this person in 4 months. Can I get them to call me? And they started doing these kinds of little experiments, and they found that they could influence people to do it. And this person started talking about, once they realized that they could, it's like it became disgusting to them and they just couldn't do it. Like, it felt like an invasion of privacy. It felt like it was rooted in this very, it's actually a very beautiful quote, but just, it's like juvenile desires for control and power and things like that. And that it was kind of, it's almost like there was some sort of psychic reaction against that, like built into his own consciousness, that was to make him say, ugh, I don't want that. I'm not interested in that anymore. And I'm interested in that. And I wonder if such a thing is true for everyone, that, you know, you can get interested in it, but once you start getting interested in it for the wrong reasons, or maybe there's some sort of an ethical boundary that's crossed, where you do meet some resistance, not even from the outside, but sort of some sort of inward built-in resistance, right? And if maybe that's how, you know, so many people have been able to brush up and have those really incredible remote viewing experiences, but that's just something, I mean, because I don't know if you're like me, the first thing I thought was like, oh, I'm going to see if I can, this associative remote viewing book, maybe I can play the lotto, right? Like, that's my, well, everyone says, well, if it's real, how come you're not playing the lotto? It's like, well, people do, and they do win money, but for whatever reason, I just couldn't stick with it, like, to do that. Even though I had the same experience as you, you know, mm-hmm. with remote viewing, they know how to pick really good targets, right? Like they, you know, your first trial, there's, you know, ways that you can pick targets that are better or worse, and they tend to pick really good targets. And I had that same thing, and it just wowed me and amazed me, and I wanted to do everything. And for whatever reason, I just didn't stick with it. But yeah.
No, I've had that too with like, you know, because like once you realize that this stuff is real, and we're like, I've, you know, dabbled with, you know, like chaos magic and that sort of thing. And it's like, same with remote viewing. It's like, as soon as I kind of like do enough to confirm to myself that there's something to this, mm-hmm. I'm somebody who, not that I don't judge people who do that stuff, but there's something about it that I find disquieting, like that I don't, you know, I especially wouldn't want to do anything that would ever. I think because I'm so obsessed with, you know, personal freedom. I think a lot of us are in, you know, this community, like we're a bunch of feral cats in a way. We're definitely outside cats. So I really identify with that. You know, I think that there's something about it that like, just because you can do it, there is something inside of you that's like, oh, maybe not that.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we're on the secrecy piece. You know, I was just thinking there's a quote as well where there is a point where they were looking at, and this was, this was when the remote viewing program was under, there were still things going on at SRI, excuse me, but it was also, it was at the DIA, right? It wasn't yet, later on, it went to SAIC. I think they were still at SRI at this point. But they were having the meeting at the DOD. There was a DOD working group on remote viewing. And, you know, members of the intelligence community, including the CIA, was there, right? They were there and they were kind of talking about it. And there was a representative there connected to the NSC, and which is a big deal. And this person said that basically that the members of the NSC were concerned that remote viewing might constitute a violation of privacy. And so they wanted to look into it. And, you know, I look at that and I say, they're not really worried about, you know, oh, is, you know, somebody going to know that, you know, I'm cheating on my taxes. Like, they're not worried about that. They're thinking about security classification and things like that. And, you know, what could somebody do if they were targeted correctly? What could they find if they were targeted correctly? So there are some other very, like, I wouldn't call them conventional, but some very conventional reasons for secrecy around remote viewing and around some of these other things. But again, with them coming out with stuff recently, I feel like somebody somewhere kind of gave the thumbs up, like, yeah, we can start talking about this again. You know, maybe because they think or it could be that maybe they think there's some reason why they may need to use it more openly. And so You know, we get it out now. Maybe we don't have to do so much explaining, you know, when it's time to rip the Band-Aid off and say, oh, surprise. Yeah, we do this all the time.
Yeah, no, that is fascinating. I've noticed that as well. It seems to be popping up everywhere and people are suddenly talking about it. Well, I feel like I could just keep chatting with you for hours. You're up on our time, so I will let you go. But Daniel, thank you so much for being on the show. Thank you for the work that you've done, the contributions that you've made to the community. They've really helped me a lot. I really recommend people check your work out. And just thanks for being here. It was a great conversation.
Thanks so much. It's been a huge honor.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Strieber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Strieber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.